I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and with Ken Nash, we're building bridges. American Friends Service Committee immigration attorney Stephen Sacco joins us to say, I am my sibling's keeper. Stop blaming immigrants. And how did we get to this point anyway? What is to be done? Well, Steve, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And I was thinking of you in the early morning hours, but not quite as early as this tweet that came through at 4 a.m. from Trump, who tweeted out his intention to use the military to drag workers, our neighbors, out of their homes and deport them. And then there are those with TPS, temporary protective status, such as our Haitian COMPAS, buddies, which is what the organization Ice Watch prefers to call the newer arrivals to this country rather than immigrants, which has become somewhat stigmatized. They receive, of course, they have temporary status, such as the Haitians, many of whom were arrivals after the, or in the midst, virtually, of the huge earthquake that killed tens of thousands of them. And then there are the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DREAMers, of undocumented parents who similarly have status, although still temporary. And the question really is, can all these different groups, those completely without papers, those such as the TPSers, the DREAMers, and so on, be wrested away by the military? And then we're going to try to look at enhancing really the whole dialogue around immigration towards the end of really developing an agenda that is far more democratic and less reactive than what we have been used to. And you're the person to help us do that. So let's begin by your thoughts about Donald Trump, President-elect's 4 a.m. tweet to use the military to round up our neighbors.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about these incomprehensibly important things. You know, as they say, Mimi, our liberation is bound up together. No one is an injustice everywhere, right? Sacrifice is justice for each person everywhere. So I think it's important to kind of understand. I think that's a good starting point to kind of understand the context where all of these unbelievably terrifying things are coming at us from this the new administration to be. I want to stress, I think, that in giving us context, that I think what we think of as quote-unquote immigration laws, the deportation citizenship system, is really the product of a symbiosis between capital and nationalism and race. No one of those three is driving the bus, but they're all engaged in, I think, in a symbiotic relationship, right? Capital needs wedges to break up worker solidarity. Nationalism and race are ideologies that provide that wedge. They're a taxonomy in the service of domination, right? They break people into groups so that one group can dominate the other. And so each of those feed each other, and the history of immigration, deportation, citizenship laws demonstrates that, right? You have all of the large changes to deportation law are this, you can see this this process of capital feeding nationalism and nationalism feeding capital. And I think, you know, I think there's a lot that's been written, you know, about the racial bribe of whiteness. You know, certainly if you go to the origin of immigration law, it's founded in whiteness and in white nationalism, right? The very first naturalization law of 1790 states that, you know, citizenship is limited to white people. It's explicitly racial. The first big deportation laws, the Chinese Exclusion Acts, are explicitly racial. It's explicitly racial system and racial social engineering system. But a lot has been written about this, the racial bribe of whiteness, right? Whiteness itself is sort of introduced into American law in the 17th century, but before the United States. It's introduced into North American law. And it's invented there as a racial bribe, as a way to for lower and middle income people, white people, as a way to offer for them economic or political domination of someone else in exchange for their not resisting or organizing against capital. They'll accept sort of subjugation of the capitalist system in exchange for this racial domination, a guaranteed racial caste over other people, over other racialized people. They'll accept this own white racialization as a racial bribe. But and so there's a lot been written about that. I think what we don't realize and we don't think of enough is that nationalism also functions as a bribe in this same way. And when I say nationalism, Mimi, I mean all nationalism, not just white nationalism, but also the allegedly benign patriotism. All forms of nationalism, function in this way. I'm going to accept the status of American, of citizen, and that allows me to exclude and subjugate non-citizens or non-Americans. And I'll accept awful conditions under capitalism in exchange for this guarantee of superior caste or of the ability to exploit or dominate others. In that sense, I think that upper caste position can be built on whiteness, or it can be built on being an American. And all nationalism, I think, is kind of pregnant with authoritarianism, because all nationalism is underwritten by this national bribe that you can accept a higher caste in exchange for dominating others, and you'll accept sort of brutal conditions under capital to do so. And you'll trade anything for that domination, including democracy. And we're all, I think, maybe captured by this process. All of us are being bribed with this national bribe to sort of accept economic and political dominance in exchange for brutal conditions under capitalism. Some of us accept that bribe, some of us don't. And I think those of us who are living in more brutalized economic conditions are more likely to take that bribe, right, out of desperation. So if you're struggling to pay rent, you can't make ends meet, you're working slave wages, you're going to be more likely to take that nationalist bribe, I think, than someone more well off. And I think that, goes to, I think, explaining some of what we've seen in the election, and explains why this particular barbarian has the support that he has. Some people have accepted this, traditional white racial bribe, but others have accepted a nationalist bribe that I'll be able to dominate others, and so maybe that will buy me some economic or political security in this otherwise incredibly difficult system that capitalism has built for me.
You know,
And that it,
it's
oh, go ahead.
interesting that when I first read, and I think it's one of the most important books that one can read about the origin, if you will, of this country and the conceptualization of white supremacy and the development of plantation capitalism, and that is Black Reconstruction by W.E.B. Du Bois, who
Sure.
talks about just the kind of things that you're relating to, why somebody who is white would be the overseer. Why would you be the overseer? And why not identify with the very person, the enslaved person that you are entrusted with the brutalization, suppression, and oppression of? And what Du Bois tells us is that at least in the position of overseer, you can aspire to move from that degrading indignity and immiseration yourself to relating to and getting certainly better crumbs, if nothing else, from the master's table. So you become the overseer. So there's that kind of material bribe, which in capitalism, which is why the phrase to me, plantation capitalism, is very important, is that ours is a classist and a racialized kind of capitalism that is very specific, and which you are now evoking the history of in an immigration context to help us understand why people from the working class would sell out their interests and betray their own siblings who are in precisely the situation that many of them, if not them, certainly their parents were in just years earlier.
Right. And Du Bois calls these crumbs the wages of whiteness. And so I think we're looking at the wages of nationalism to explain a lot of what's going on and a lot of the deportation laws that we all struggle under.
But let me also just probe a little deeper. I guess I've always thought about, I've taken citizenship for granted in one sense, because it's there, I have it. And it just seemed to be more of a moniker of convenience and designation in accordance with the contemporary concepts of the nation state. But you are describing it as something that is very, again, supremacist, preferential, and hardly benign, but actually a form that breaks down democracy. So talk a little bit more about that whole concept of citizenship, of borders, and the contemporary nation state. Help us understand a little bit more about the concept of citizenship as not democratic.
Yeah, and some of what I've written describes citizenship as the opposite of democracy, that it's really, it's a caste system. It's inherently anti-egalitarian and anti-liberatory, and it's really incompatible with democratic society for that reason. And part of the reason that it's incompatible is that, as I said, all nationalism is sort of pregnant with this authoritarianism. And I think citizenship is just the legal expression of nationalism and nationality. And I think what's key to understand is that when we accept this sort of system of domination, we think of it as, you know, certainly it's obviously and, you know, urgently detrimental to the people who are excluded from it. It becomes a source of a great violence and brutality toward them. But I think we also lose sight of how it endangers the rest of us. In as much as it's, you know, underwritten by racialization, citizenship also functions to racialize citizens of color. There's a scholar whose name escapes me who has written, you know, that when the U.S. deports someone who is Haitian or a demagogue speaks against Haitian people in a racialized way, that isn't just an attack on a Haitian person, that is an attack on blackness, right? It's implicit there is an inherent white supremacy. And so that, you know, feeds into a racialized system for everyone. But I think it's also important to realize that the citizenship erodes democracy for all of us, right? For example, a lot has been written about how whiteness is always threatening to destroy democracy. There is a very well-known article by a law professor named Paul Butler called The White Fourth Amendment, where he writes about how the Fourth Amendment is the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. And typically when those cases interpreting that amendment make it to the Supreme Court, typically the person asking for their liberties under that amendment is a person of color. And there's a lot of case law where the decision comes out in a way that weakens that freedom and that right, because there's an inherent, you know, white supremacy and racialization to the outcome of that case. The person of color loses. And of course, that erodes the Fourth Amendment for all of us, not just people of color, right? We lose constitutional rights. We live in a, we all end up living in a weaker democracy because of that whiteness. And you see a similar process going on with nationalism and with citizenship, right? What is fueling many of the attacks on the voting system, on access to the vote for the far right? A lot of it is this mythology about, oh no, what if non-citizens vote? So let's just make voting harder for everyone so that, God forbid, someone who's not a citizen doesn't vote. And of course, no one sort of captures this sort of erosion of democracy that's implicit to citizenship, as well as he who shall not be named, who will take office in January. His entire project is the destruction of democracy in the name of the preservation of the boundary between national and foreigner. You will accept that authoritarianism, those crumbs, if you're and you'll sacrifice anything for it, even your own safety. I'm reminded also of a book by Jonathan Metzl called "Dying of Whiteness," who wrote about how, the racialization of public benefits and public medical care causes white people to reject those benefits, to vote against their own interests. As a result, they die from lack of medical care. Citizenship also draws that boundary, excluding non-citizens from basic public assistance. So I think drawing that boundary
Beautiful.
between citizen and non-citizen creates this feedback loop that makes society less free for everyone.
The issue of the very pragmatic one now of really what is to be done and how do we begin to wean from the body politic this white supremacy that allows people to adopt the value system that will become exclusionary, or worse, even allow for people to be put in camps, as we did with Japanese who were in fact citizens at the time, or other groups of people where we could conceivably, and for those of us who have been in the legal system, let me say I've spent years watching ICE agents prowl around the lower courts of the city, profiling people and trying to take immigrants out of their positions within this society. So I take very seriously, I know you do, and the question is, what do we need to say to people to prepare them to be doing the necessary defense and legally, what can be done in response to a Trumpist and the Trump juggernaut that is telling us at 4 a.m. in the morning that he is prepared to send the military into, and I believe, as it has happened historically, the urban areas such as New York and Chicago and places like that to tear away from their homes, their families, the newly arrived people. Workers, or as Che said, capital knows no borders. Why the hell should the working class?
I think there's an imperative to mobilize as locally as possible, to answer that question. I think we want to focus on building, local neighborhood scale associations, mutual aid groups, other associations, to knit networks together at the local level, so that we can build the kind of grassroots power that we will need to resist whatever horrible thing is coming our way. And I think legally, the strategy is the same. We are going to be able to move the status quo most easily the more local level we're talking about, at the municipal level and at the maybe at the state level, but more at the town and city level. One of the things that I think is really one of the sort of local initiatives that's taken place sporadically around the country in the last 30, 40 years is the push for non-citizen voting at the municipal and local level. So opening up a mayoral or a city council or school board elections to non-citizens, to people who are not citizens, maybe don't have papers at all. What's important about that is that it breaks down the barrier between citizen and non-citizen, which I believe is crucial for democracy. And it also invests political power in non-citizens, in neighbors, in your non-citizen neighbors, if you are a citizen. And if you are a non-citizen, it gives you real a different lever to pull in your community. It also creates a shared interest, I think, politically speaking, between citizens and non-citizens at the municipal and local level. And this is being done kind of all over the country. In fact, this year, in Edmundston, Maryland, a town of like 1,600 people, they passed non-citizen voting. There's one of 16 jurisdictions in Maryland where that is the case. So I think, there are things that can be done like that at a local level, with the law. There's lots of movement around city and municipal IDs so that everyone in the city has the same identification, regardless of immigration or citizenship status. There are also very local laws that could prohibit local law enforcement from collaborating with federal citizenship and immigration enforcement. These are the kinds of things very locally that we can do, I think, to build the kind of networks that we need to resist, that terrifying, black truck that, is parked on a corner. It says ICE on the side that we know is hunting our neighbors. And to resist whatever other horrible thing like that is coming down the pike for us.
The American Friends Service Committee has been a service entity, and that is in its broadest sense. It has a legal component, but it does organizing. It does organizing. It has for almost 100 years of its existence. And I'm just wondering if there's a particular role or instruction that can be played through the American Friends Service Committee with people who want to learn how to do that, who want to learn how to be ICE watchers, defenders of their neighbors, to put into play the reality, I am my neighbor's keeper, and to deal with this vast infrastructure of violence that is being set up and its ideological basis to enforce these rules of scapegoating and that divide the working class and do everything they can to distract from the real oppressor, whether it's materially or whether it is politically, socially, and so on. That is the plutocrats, the Trumpites, and their ilk. So, I mean, where do we take this now? What can we do? What should be done? How do we put things in place to act on our concern for really pushing for an egalitarian, democratic society where all are not only welcome, but are able to reach their full potential with the assistance of the state?
I think there are, we want to act locally. I think there are many, many people doing a lot of amazing work, like the organizers at AFSC, but many other places and localities around the continent. And I definitely reach out to them and ask them the ways that you can be useful and helpful. A lot of them are trying to pass laws at the state and municipal level, and they could use you to help them lobby, to help them make phone calls, and to do 100 other things that I can't even name because I am myself not an organizer. But you should talk to the organizers in your community, and you should ask them, what should you do? Who can you help? There will be answers. Every community has, some organized group of people who are doing that kind of work.
And it is your thesis that in the United States, that racism has been constructed and baked into the citizenship law, and that is inherently undemocratic, and that the privileges, such as they are, that inure to citizenship, are what allow people to buy into the hatred and bias of the other, if you will.
Absolutely. There is no such thing, there can be no such thing as an anti-racist citizenship or immigration law. That's impossible because, at its core, that is the essence of what it is. It is a hierarchical caste system that creates an other and that it racializes. It is the distinction between foreigner and national that the law engenders, that is the kernel of race. And in that sense, you really can't untie nation from race in that way, in reality and in law. And that's why I think we need a different model for how we think about political membership and how we think about community.
Well, thank you for that. And that's something that we really have to have a greater discussion on, citizenship as racism and anti-democracy. And
Happy to anytime.
well, thank you for beginning that. And we're certainly going to have you back to continue that discussion because it is also incumbent upon us to tackle the, pull out roots and branch, as they say, the basis of the kind of bias and hatred, the white supremacy, and the codification of citizenship and other things to break down what are. Should be an internationalist and a humanist perspective that defines the human condition. We might even save the planet if we were able to do that.
We could put away nationalism and citizenship. I'm confident we would be much better on our way doing to do so, yes.
Well, Stephen Sacco, for the work that you do as a lawyer and the theoretical work as somebody who is grappling with the issue of what democracy looks like and what impedes it, aside from the various individuals with their tropes and so on. But there's a theoretical basis and a basis of white supremacy, again, to root out, pull out from the poisoned soil, root and branch for a beloved community that Martin Luther King longed for and worked for, one that is egalitarian, internationalist. Thank you. No more poisoned nationalism. It's been a great pleasure speaking with you. And we will act on your considerations. And if you want more information, you can certainly go to the website of the American Friends Service Committee and you can touch base with folks there. You can touch base with organizations like Ice Watch, which are proactive to trying to prevent actual deportations and building mass defense committees. We got a lot of work to do and a short period of time to do it, but what do we do when we're under attack? We fight back with people like Stephen Sacco. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks so much, Mimi. I appreciate it.